This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim.
This week on the show, enough talk about hyperlocal journalism. We want to see it in action. Will e-readers turn us all into book pirates, and our love affair with Twitter is cooling off? All this on This Week in Media 154. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of your favorite podcast. I hope it's your favorite, or maybe at least in your top 100. This Week in Media, I'm your host, Daisy Whitney. I'm here in studio at Leo Laporte's Twit Cottage headquarters. So for those of you who are watching or listening live, welcome. I do want to let you know I don't actually have the chat room open on my computer, so I'm not going to be able to respond to questions or stuff like that right now, but I may try to do that at the end. But I do appreciate you being there. If I look at the chat room, I'll be totally distracted and won't be able to have a normal conversation with my guest. Yes, and I'm very pleased to let you know that Tim Street, as usual, is here with us. Hello, Tim. How was your weekend?
Hey, Daisy. It was pretty good. I got back from Boston. I was in Boston for the inbound marketing. Well, you know what? I wasn't really in Boston. I flew into Boston and took a bus to a place called Foxborough in the middle of the woods. They built this stadium called Gillette Stadium and a little mall. And that's where I spent a lot of time.
Did you have to go to see a football game?
No, but I did see him practice, and then, more importantly, I went to the Burger Place Five Guys. Highly recommended.
Burger Place. Okay, it's always good to have Boston Burger recommendations. So, and you've got Blog World coming up soon, too, so people will be able to see, hear you there, right?
Absolutely. I'll be juggling cats in Las Vegas, and you can come see my show. I'll be talking about iPhones. iPhones are good. And also about using online video to sell your products and services.
I want to see you juggling cats. I recently discovered this weekend the joy of the ICANN has cheeseburger lolcats. And I think it's pretty much Mana from Humor Heaven. Yeah, I know it's from last year. I didn't say I was always ahead of trends. I don't know why they let me host this show. And then we also have, back by popular demand, Brett Rounceville, a.k.a. Elm Trekker. And what have you been up to? Are you allowed to talk about any of the projects we were emailing about last night? I know you're kind of dabbling in a couple different media areas, publishing, TV possibly, some things in development.
Yeah, there's a couple of big things that I probably shouldn't talk about just now. Most of what I've been doing is like working behind the scenes, working with a couple of companies, and then I might have a little thing on the real shows coming out soon. And then I do a BB Live show with Brian Brushwood and Justin R. Young once a week, so that's always fun.
Right,
kind of
right.
A train run.
We love Brian Brushwood. We are big fans of his. And of course, people will also know you from your web series, Am Trekker, where you did many, many things on a list. And we have a lot of exciting stories to talk about today. But first, I want to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, Internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. And you should get a free audiobook of your choice by signing up. You should go to audiblepodcast.com/twim, which of course stands for This Week in Media, T-W-I-M. Audible has over 50,000 titles to choose from that can be downloaded and played back anywhere. And of course, I would love to pass on a recommendation, as I often do. I am recommending Prophecy of the Sisters by Michelle Zink. It is a fantastic story. It's actually the first in a trilogy. So if you like it, you'll be able to get the next one next summer. And the actress, Elijah Dushku, does a terrific job as an audio narrator. It's kind of cool to have someone of her caliber reading it, and she does a great job, so check it out. I was listening to her this morning, as a matter of fact. Audible, and you go to audiblepodcast.com/twim for a free audiobook of your choice. There you go. She is a star of Dollhouse. How's that show doing? Yeah, okay. Do you guys watch Dollhouse?
Hasn't been canceled yet.
Yeah, it hasn't been canceled. That's
sometimes
that's
all you can say for a TV show, right?
Yeah.
They haven't pulled the plug on it yet. Daily Motion has raised some more money. So this is a company that has already raised $43.5 million since 2006 and now has to find another $22.1 million. And let's see, the company had, just to go through kind of its venture funding so far, this is a story from Paid Content, has already taken $9.5 million in setup money from Atlas Venture and Partech International, another $34 million from Advent Venture Partners and AGF Private Equity, so on and so forth. But the company is basically basically finding it's profitable at the operating level, but it's basically finding that bandwidth costs are rising faster than profits. So I don't know. Tim, what's the potential here for Daily Motion? I know you're familiar with the site. I mean, how big is this money challenge? It seems that it could be a bit concerning for the future of the company.
Well, I think a lot of these online video sites forget to look between the cushions on the couch for that extra money. And Daily Motion, you know, being from France, they need to do that. They're huge in France, by the way. I think they're bigger than YouTube there. Hey, this is one of those things where, you know, you look at YouTube. YouTube has been subsidizing online video. You know, they've been losing money as well, but they've got Google behind them. So when we get the true cost of online video down, I think that's when we're going to have a business. So, you know, we lost a lot of online video sites this last year, and, you know, there has to be a business model there. Because, you know, you are reaching millions of people, but I'm not paying anything for YouTube right now. My videos are there. They're there for free. Daily Motion is paying money to different partners to put their videos there and feature them, and they're sharing revenues, which is great. I mean, I like that idea a lot.
Is that a good business idea? I mean, I know that Hayden Black has the Cabinots on there, and that Daily Motion has spent some money to acquire that as a pilot. Obviously, as content producers, we love the idea of someone paying upfront for money,
I think, upfront for
a show, but I wonder, is it an actual reasonable business model for a site?
Well, I think there's a lot of business that they haven't really explored. You know, a lot of these sites have videos that they can't sell advertising on. Well, let's take, for example, some bikini booty shaking videos. There are very few advertisers that would want to advertise on that UGC content. But if a site like Daily Motion used that content to leverage other shows that they have that they can advertise, if they could figure out a model to take all those views that are going wasted and drive traffic to other videos that they can monetize, I think there's a huge business model there, you know, doing that cross-channel promotion type stuff. But they're not doing it.
Brett, do you go to Daily Motion at all?
I do. Actually, I probably get next to YouTube, the second most views on my site come from Daily Motion. And there's actually a correction to this article this morning, too, that says that their sales are now outstripping outgoings on bandwidth, which makes up to 25% of the costs. It doesn't break down what their sales are or if it's all from advertising against the videos or against the views. But apparently they're on the right track. They're learning something.
So doing better than the first iteration of the story. So obviously I wonder if Daily Motion was not happy with the story or what have you. But there was an update basically saying that they're better off than portrayed. But,
yeah, absolutely.
But you're finding that people are going there and finding you through Daily Motion. So that's encouraging as a content provider. You just upload your videos there, though, right? There's no sort of special agreement or anything beyond a standard upload, is there?
Anything. And in addition, I mean, I may get the second most views out of Daily Motion, but that's not saying a lot. I mean, YouTube is where it's at. And this isn't counting iTunes or my own site either, But YouTube is still where all the people are watching.
Speaking of YouTube, there's some question that YouTube employees might have uploaded Viacom copyrighted material, which will, of course, cut right to the heart of the big $1 billion copyright lawsuit. Yeah, it's interesting. This lawsuit has been going on for a year or so now, and it's always sort of there in the background, but then it rears its head at moments like this. But basically, a story late last week in CNET that said lawyers working on this may have uncovered evidence that employees of YouTube were among those who uploaded unauthorized content to YouTube. That there were some internal YouTube emails circling around that said YouTube managers might have known of and discussed the existence of unauthorized content on the site with employees, but chose not to remove the material. This, of course, is what sources have told CNET. So there's this is very telling and very important. If it is indeed true, and there's you know, again, this is a lawsuit. I don't know one way or the other. I'm just reporting what was said in this story. But if managers possessed actual knowledge of copyright infringement on the site and did not quickly remove it, the company may not be entitled to protection under the DMCA safe harbor provision. This is what some legal experts have said. Because one of the elements of the safe harbor provision is that the services don't have actual knowledge that the material or an activity using material on the system or network is infringing. Brett, I'm gonna throw this one to you. I mean, one, there's the issue of, is this actually occurring? Did this occur? And I don't know how we can kind of, you know, guess on that all day long. Is this a big blow, or do you see this as sort of part and parcel of the process of a big case going to, you know, either court or to be settled eventually?
I think it's a fair-sized blow to the YouTube Viacom trial specifically, or case specifically, rather, but it doesn't seem like it's going to play a very large part in the actual setting of precedents with the DMCA. I don't think it's going to cause any real uproar or anything. And actually, the most interesting part of this article that I found was when they talked about how in the early days, Viacom was one of the biggest uploaders of Viacom material on YouTube. So it's kind of hard to separate where the line is drawn. How do they decide when they're getting their marketing value out of uploading these videos and when they're actually losing money on content? So it seems like, if nothing else, there's a lot of room for them to come together and decide on something that's going to work best for both people rather than attacking each other in this weird new digital world that everyone's trying to figure out.
Tim, do you see that? Do you think that these sort of back and forths, and we found this and you found this, might actually lead to a settlement between the two companies?
Well, I'm shocked. I'm just shocked that I can't believe that anybody would think that YouTube somehow knew that this was copyrighted material. I mean, of course they didn't know. There was no way. I mean, you know, you can't know just by looking at something whether or not somebody from the company put it up or somebody else. They might be doing it, you know, secretly.
Okay, so you think this is that the allegations are spurious, or I can't tell if you're actually being serious or not.
No, I'm not being serious.
Okay, so tell us what you really think then. So do you think does this bring them closer to a settlement then, or further apart?
I think it's going to bring them closer to a settlement because it blurs the lines and it just makes it harder to figure out what's going on here. I mean, the end result, they've both benefited from it. Whether or not Viacom's going to get $1 billion from Google or not, we'll see who benefits the most there. But I'm glad I'm not the judge on this one because it looks like a really murky, murky case.
Well, right. That's ultimately, I think, what's happening with this is that the deeper that anyone digs into this, you see that there's a culpability on both sides, which I think it just is the sort of thing that leads, that may indeed lead to a solution. A couple journalism stories wanted to touch on. One of our regular listeners, Rich Estelle, passed this on to me, and it is a story that was from, actually more kind of like a report from, I hope I get the name of this group right, but I think it's like the Nieman Research Group. It's part of a Harvard kind of journalism studies. Oh gosh, look at that. It's right in front of my notes. Michael Scholer reports in the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. All right, good job reading what's in front of you, Daisy. It's really interesting. I'll link this out if anybody, you know, wants specifics. You know, email me also if, you know, we haven't gotten around to show notes yet. Sorry. It's a dream, you know, and maybe someday. But the take here is that
I posted show notes on my website.
Well, you should let me know so I can tweet that and let other people know. That's pretty cool that you do that. And we can direct people to it. So social media sites, of course, are not doing journalism. You know, although often you'll find breaking news shows up there. A lot of people learned about the plane crash in the Hudson River from Twitter and so on and so forth. So what this story kind of analysis really looks into is what are some of the ways that social media and journalism can kind of better come together? Because, of course, social media sites, what Michael says, aren't really models for new journalism, but they kind of give an idea of what should be done. Because you'll hear newsrooms saying, we need to be on Facebook, we need to be on Twitter. And certainly when I was at TV Week, that was, you know, there was very much that sort of frenzied push. Like, okay, now do we need to develop an iPhone app because everyone has an iPhone app, or we need to Twitter out our stories. But what this story points out is what the real value for journalists is in truly understanding the relationships that these social media sites, which are now so popular, are enabling. And he says that people aren't fooled by false interaction if they see that the news staffs don't read the comments or citizen reports, respond and pursue the best ideas and knowledge of the audience to improve their own reporting. Journalists can't make reporting more relevant to the public until we stop assuming that we know what people want and start listening to the audience. I wonder who's actually doing this. I mean, I wonder if there are any journalistic associations, outlets that are actually taking this advice and listening to their readers and their viewers through these social media channels rather than just using it to push out and link out stories and try to go for as a maximum effect as possible. You know, without being inside a lot of them, what do you guys see? Do you think many are?
Well, I'm happy to leave it open to debate, but I think that this may be one of the few cases where social media's power is kind of overstated. I think we're all still getting all of the information we used to get. The people that are hurting are the people like LA Times or San Francisco Chronicle, who had this huge piece of a pie because people were locked into LA. That's where they got their news, and they had this huge population to work with. Now people have this access to all these other inputs of information, and it's not so much that their audience is disappearing. Those same people are still there. They're still getting information. They're spreading out across the globe and getting the right information where they want it, when they want it. I don't know that social media can help that.
Tim, are you seeing any examples of news outlets that you think are effectively listening to their readers?
I take a look at CNN, and I think CNN's paying attention. The Today Show's paying attention. You know, these are media outlets, but there's a lot of what happened in the train industry that's happening here. I mean, the train industry, when airplanes came out and airline travel started, they were like, well, we're not an airline business, we're train people. And they didn't realize that they're in the transportation business. And I think that same thing is happening here. I mean, if you step back from this and you look at it, there's always been letters to the editor. They get printed and get answered and get studied. Why aren't they doing that now on the internet? Why aren't they paying attention to the things they've always, you know, there's always been, well, not always, but almost always been call-ins for radio shows. You know, why aren't they just adapting that to a new media? It makes no sense to me that they seem to be missing the ball on utilizing the tools that they've already used and just adapting them to a new channel.
Right. I think they're doing a little too much pushing out. One of the outlets, Silicon Alley Insider, I used to read it a lot more when Michael Learmonth was over there. Now he's with Ad Age, and I think he's really a tremendous reporter and does a great job reporting on digital media. And actually, I should have him on this show. But he was quite good at that interaction. I mean, he was writing 6 to 8 blog posts a day while at Silicon Alley Insider. And if you left a comment, you know, he'd go right back and respond to your comment. I mean, you could look at sort of his trail of comments and there'd be, you know, 4 or 5 would come in from a reader and then he'd go back and respond to all of them. And every now and then, some of those would warrant a change in the story or an addition to the story. And I think that creates that sort of fluidity and river of information and all of that that people like about social media. So I think that's a good example. But I think that probably...
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Brett. Go ahead.
That's where I think that social media can help, like, the individual reporter like that. I don't think it's going to do a lot for large news sources. I think, if anything, we're going to see journalism go the route of graphic artists, where everyone's freelance now, and that's how you make your money. That people are going to pay attention to the name of the reporter more than the name of the newspaper, I think, especially if these individual reporters are doing such a good job of responding to their constituents.
Right. No, I do. I believe it. I think there's some truth to it. But I do think organizations as a whole can do a better job having a social media strategy that's about true interaction and not just about let's add a comment feature to our stories or let's tweet out our stories. You know, I mean, there are companies that do this well. I mean, Hulu has done a good job using Twitter to interact and respond to, okay, we heard about an outage or we heard about somebody having problems. So we write back to them, you know, we at reply to them. I think those same sort of kind of best practices are not really being applied very well in the journalism world. But speaking of journalism, one of the trends that still is actually getting a lot of attention and money is hyperlocal journalism. It's something that we talk about a lot on the show. It continues to be a big issue. NPR received a grant for hyperlocal journalism, $3 million in funding to launch a new journalism project that will focus on providing in-depth hyperlocal coverage coverage on community-specific issues on an online platform. NPR received $2 million from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, $1 million from the Knight Foundation, and this is basically going to go to a pilot group of about a dozen NPR stations and give them the resources to do more in-depth hyper-local news on topics that are relevant to the community where the station is located. And these grants are also going to allow the stations to hire new journalist bloggers. It's interesting, to your point, Brad, I wonder if these journalist bloggers will be staffers, or it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that they'll be staffers. I mean, so much of what I'm hearing in general from news outlets like NBC, on the TV station side, having kind of this very localized model and having a blog network, is that that's sort of the whole point, is that you can outsource a lot of this at a much lower pay rate to local bloggers who have somewhat of a profile or not in their own community, but you don't have to have them on staff. I don't know. I guess I'm a little skeptical right now about the hyper-local model, because I think we're hearing about it repeatedly. And I wonder if that is actually, if it's actually being driven by readers and by consumers, or if it is what news outlets think we want. Brett, what do you think?
I think it'll be interesting to see someone actually do it for a change. I think we've heard about it several times already, and ABC was one of the first to jump on that bandwagon, and their local reporters were all war correspondents. So it'll be interesting to see someone actually pull someone out of the community and see if they can build news around that. I have a friend that runs a website in San Francisco that talks all about the goings on during the weekends and the hip stuff to go play with for free and do for cheap. And she does really well in that hyper-local atmosphere. But I don't think that the big people have done anything hyper-local. They've just called it hyper-local.
Right, or they've made acquisitions like MSNBC purchasing every blog, which, who knows? I'm open to the fact that these could turn into good decisions and good business models. I don't know that the evidence is there yet, but certainly we're seeing a lot of efforts. Fisher Communications is doing that with some of its TV stations, but Fisher is very active in the Seattle community with I think King and Como. But there's been a lot of pushback from local folks there who just don't feel that they're doing as good a job as sort of existing. Actual locally owned sites run by real local people like myballard.com and places like that. So, Tim, what's your take on hyperlocal journalism? Do we actually want this?
It's one of those things, we don't know that we want it until we need it. I don't know what those things are that are going to determine whether or not we need it. I always think about what are the important local issues that you care about that you can't find on Twitter, or that you can't find, through the internet some way. And if those channels are developed where it's important and it's meaningful to you, then it's going to succeed. But it's really tough to put your finger on what that is.
All right, so we've got a lot of skepticism about that. Hey, I have a question for you guys, a little bit off of our story list. Do you watch your shows online in high def, whether it's your shows in particular, but just whatever it is that you're watching online? Do you hit the high res button on Hulu? Do you watch high def versions on YouTube? And do you notice a difference when you do? Tim?
Yeah, I definitely notice a difference. I mean, I'm looking for the best quality that I can get. If there's a speed issue or something, then I'll watch the lower res version just so I can see it faster. But I much prefer watching it in the highest quality that I can get it on. And then also, when I hook up my laptop to a projector, I love seeing it in HD.
Brett, have you found, do you watch things in high def? And if so, have you found that the majority of the things that you want to see online have a high res, high def option?
Yeah, I think enough of it has an option. It's not a big deal for me. I mean, I'm traveling often enough that I'm usually working off of my wireless broadband card anyway, so I'd kind of rather just see it in low def. And I mean, obviously there's a difference, but unless there's something on the screen that I can't read or can't see clearly, then I'll usually just stick to the low res most of the time.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same as you, because I think it's just one more button to push. And maybe that makes me sound lazy, but if I'm going to watch something, if I'm going to settle in and watch a show, watching something with my husband, he's really focused on that. He'll always hit the high res button. If I'm just kind of watching something for information, or watch it or check the latest episode of What the Buck, which I love that show. Michael Buckley does such a good job. Michael Buckley, why don't you come on this show? Actually, I'm going to invite him. This is your official invitation, Michael Buckley. You will be on our show sometime. DVDs no longer are traffic drivers at Walmart. Walmart has been I mean, the DVD business has really kind of risen and fallen, according to Walmart. Walmart has sort of set the standards, has made DVDs a big part of what its store is all about. And now Wall Street Journal reports that there's a shift going on in the merchandising strategy by Walmart, which, of course, is the world's largest retailer, that could suggest even more trouble for DVD sales. As part of its effort to clean up its aisles and appeal to higher-end shoppers, be more like Target, Walmart is doing away with display cases that promote the latest hot movie titles. Of course, this comes right as movie studios are facing declining DVD sales in general, but also as consumers are spending more time at the red box, you know, the grocery stores where you just get the movie for, you know, 99 cents or a dollar or whatever it is, and you have it for 24 hours. Is this just sort of, Tim, is this a slow, gradual, too bad Alex isn't here. This is Alex made all over it. Alex written all over it. Oh, incidentally, yes, Alex isn't here this week. Just wanted to let you know. Is this the slow death of the DVD business, Tim?
It definitely looks like it's a first step. I mean, for the studios, they've always had a love-hate relationship with Walmart because Walmart sets the prices of whatever goes into their stores. And the studios are used to getting their ways in whatever they do, except when it comes to retail at Walmart. They've been bullied by Walmart over the years. What I'm really curious about is if DVDs aren't driving traffic, what is? What are we going to see? Pepsi set up in the aisles?
Toilet
I don't know,
paper.
You know? Toilet paper is driving people to Walmart. I mean, that's what I'm really curious about. What is driving people there?
Lotion. It's all about lotion, people. It's all about lotion and scents. And yeah, I'm not into guns.
Guns.
Can I just say something? I wish Longs had not been purchased by CVS. It's not the same. Do you have Longs where you are, Tim? Longs or CVS?
No.
No, Brett, you're up here in Northern California, right?
Yeah, we have CVS here.
I'm in Los Angeles. Yeah.
I didn't notice
a change, though. What are you worried about? Is the toilet paper more expensive now?
No, I'm not.
Are you going to Walmart now?
I'm worried. I find it a less friendly shopping experience. It just is. It's less, you know, it's just less inviting. I don't like the new layout. Whatever. It's just a drugstore. I'll deal. But I just feel like I had to weigh in on this.
Is one of those people that's just insane nice every time you go in. And she's like, hey, how you doing today? Do you want to try these Oreos? They're only 99 cents. And so she's almost a little bit too friendly for me to go in every day.
Really? Yeah, you know, you don't always want someone in your face like that when you're shopping, do you? One of our listeners wrote to me over the weekend and wanted to talk more about mobile marketing, which we chatted about last week. And that's, of course, an interesting topic, is what you actually want to be, what you want to have marketed to you when you're on the go. And, you know, I said, yeah, I think I would love it if I got coupons from Borders when I was within 10 miles of a Borders or 5 miles of a Borders, because I'm pretty much a sucker for buying books all the time, which we've already established because I read Lolcats over the weekend. And you know what's another good book? If you're looking for another good book, is Post Secret. Have you read those books, Colleen? You go to that website, is it postsecret.com? Can you put that URL up? This is fantastic. This will satisfy all of your voyeuristic desires. This is basically a website. The guy who runs this, Frank Warren, has received over 400,000 postcards in the 4 or 5 years that he's been doing this, and they all have people's secrets on them. And just some really good stuff. And I think the book that just came out last Tuesday, which actually is on the top 100 on Amazon already.
Did they publish yours? Did they publish your postcard? The one you sent in?
No, I haven't sent one in. But yeah, I'll let you know when I have a really tawdry secret and Post Secret publishes. Yeah, count on that. But that's a really good book. Post Secret, Confessions on Life, Death, and God, I think, is the name of it. I want to share just a couple stats about the DVD sales, and then we'll go on to another topic. But this is also in the Wall Street Journal story. The Digital Entertainment Group estimates that overall U.S. retail sales fell 13.5% to $5.4 billion during the first half of 2009, obviously recession, whatnot. At the same time, DVD rentals rose by 8.3% to $3.4 billion. Digital sales and rentals from services like Amazon and Apple rose 21% to $968 million. And then video on demand revenue from cable operators, Comcast and so on and so forth, is up 11% from last year. So as we're seeing DVD sales suffering, the rental business and especially the digital business is doing well. Speaking of digital and speaking of going back to books, you're not really going to be able to find Post Secret on the Kindle because, you know, it's all about the artwork and how the how the postcards look. But so Kindle last week introduced a cheaper version. It's down, the price is down to $2.59. And there also is now an international version of the Kindle that works in more than 100 countries. This has been one of the rubs against the Kindle, is that you can only use it when you're in the U.S. And even U.S. users have complained that when they've traveled to Canada, they haven't been able to buy and download new books. So this is good kind of extending the dominance of it. A couple interesting Kindle stats that I want to share with you guys. The U.S. Kindle store has more than 350,000 books, and more than 75,000 titles have been added to the store in the past 5 months. And Jeff Bezos also said that for every 100 printed copies of a title sold, Amazon.com sells 48 Kindle books, assuming the book is available in both versions. I assume those are Amazon stats purely, and that's up from 35 digital books 5 months ago, he said. I think people still want to know how many total Kindles have been sold. Brett, do you have a Kindle?
I don't have a Kindle. I've actually just had my love renewed for the world's most legal version of content piracy, our local library. So I've been spending a lot of time there.
Good for you. What are you reading these days?
Oh, I've been going through. Actually, right now I'm reading The Count of Monte Cristo finally, because the Three Musketeers, like my all time favorite book, and people always want me to check this one out. And it is it's a long book. I had no idea.
No idea when you were back in high school we had to read books of that length. I know, it was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, this thing's a brick.
Yeah, they're very long. I've been thinking more. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal last week about the mythical Apple tablet versus the Kindle. I don't know if you guys saw it. It's nothing we haven't chatted about, but I'm really beginning to think that if this tablet comes out, that that people are going to be switching. The Kindle readers and e-readers, when it's time to upgrade, are going to be switching over to the Apple version.
If it works like an iPhone, yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine being able to experience new types of stories where you read some, you watch some videos, and it's in color and it kind of works like an iPhone. I'm excited. I'm hoping it's all going to be there.
Now, I don't know. I don't know that I'll watch videos when I'm reading. I like the separation in the experience. When I'm reading, I just want to be reading. But I definitely think that if it can be expanded to the size, it's going to be a lot prettier. I love my Kindle, as everybody knows, but it's a little bit murky. The screen itself is a little bit murky. But let's talk about Brett. Even though you're in love with the library, which is good and I think should be applauded, what are your thoughts? We haven't talked to you in a while. What are your thoughts on the e-reader marketplace as a whole? Is Sony going to be a viable competitor? Is the Kindle going to dominate in this regard? And if you were to get one, what would you want it to be able to do?
I'm still a big fan of the e-readers. I think my thing, though, is more about the store attached to the e-reader than anything. I don't think that Sony has it down. I think Amazon being able to buy them right there while you're reading is amazing. And if Apple can emulate that in some way and have the store of books, then they have a solid chance. If they don't come up to bat with as good a store as Amazon has, though, then I don't see any reason why people would change over.
Yep, I think that's true. Fair to say, but I think there's a good chance that it will be quite good. And, a lot of people
either of you guys check
like
out
those Apple 26, products.
The Anthony Zeiker book that came out last month?
I haven't read that. What's your take on that?
It was interesting. It was a lot like what Tim was talking about, where you read maybe 5 chapters or so, and then you watch a video on it. And it was interesting. It wasn't what I would have liked to have seen. It wasn't everything I had hoped it would be when I heard the pitch. But it was definitely an interesting take. And my biggest problem with it was that it wasn't on like some sort of Apple tablet or something. So I couldn't read 20 chapters and watch a video unless I was right next to my laptop or something. And that was pretty frustrating and not necessarily the way I would want to absorb content. But
right.
It's still a neat idea.
You need to make that jump still. You need to make that jump from the actual physical book to getting onto your computer. Actually, this week is the Frankfurt Book Fair. And that's a big deal in the publishing business. You'll find that a lot of foreign rights, international rights, are sold during the Frankfurt Book Fair. A lot of big books are auctioned and purchased by publishing houses there. There's an interesting story in Reuters about just how much publishing is changing. And when you think about the music business and how it's been, you know, roiled by digital distribution and specifically by piracy, I wonder what this story proposed or postulated was that there could be a day when enough people have e-readers. It's certainly not today, but when enough people have e-readers, that whenever a book comes out, as happens now for music, somebody would just, you know, scan it, reproduce it online as a PDF, and then make it freely available on a file sharing site, a sort of a Napster, a LimeWire, whatever it is, you know, BitTorrent type of thing, and that the people would just pick up books that way. This is obviously what's happened to the music business. Down the road, Brett, do you see that this is something that could happen to publishing as well? I mean, we're right at the forefront. We're right at the beginning where e-readers are fun and interesting and sexy, and the publishing business is starting to figure out digital. And right now, the publishing business is reaping the benefits that exist from this segment. But couldn't that easily be flipped around maybe 5 years down the road?
I think it's something that will without a doubt happen. It's already happening to comic books. You can get all of the new comic books out 3 days later because some dude sat at his home and scanned each and every page. But I think the important thing is that the book industry is handling things better than the music industry did and making it easy to buy books now, getting people into the mode of buying books instead of having them search the illegal frontiers for what they need later on.
And then I wonder if people are trained to buy and get used to that, if they would then switch over. I guess we'll have
to
see.
If nothing else, it's a better idea than the way the music industry handled it.
And I hope people will buy books. My own selfish,
I think, at some point, because of piracy, we're going to have to switch over to some kind of metered model, to where we pay for the bandwidth that we consume. Just like there is a UPC barcode on groceries and products, it took a while for that to get established. But, you know, we're also familiar with it. We don't even notice it. We don't even think about it now when somebody scans a product at the checkout. But that same type of digital scanning is going to take place. There has to be a model set up. Otherwise, content's going to suffer. No content creator is going to want to create stuff for free. They've got to make money at it. And there has to be a way to pay the creators, whether they're writing a book, making a movie, making music, that there's got to be a way to do it.
Yeah, sometimes I just think it's the content apocalypse. Speaking of, what do you guys think about crowdsourced HD radio? This interesting story in Wired that talks about how CBS is getting ready to roll out over-the-air HD radio channels in the nation's top four markets. And it's actually going to be powered by Last.fm, which is owned by CBS, and it's the crowdsourced programming. And it's apparently the first time a streaming site has morphed into a commercial radio station. So it seems like there's kind of interesting potential there, but then I don't get HD radio. I don't understand. Like, who is that appealing to? Who wants an HD radio? Is this a technology in search of a reason to exist? Or is this what people want when it comes to listening to music?
Well, people love to pay for things that used to be free. You look at television, it used to be free. Now we love to pay for it. Radio's the same way.
Oh, now I know you're joking.
We pay for bottled water. We used to get it for free, but now we pay for it. We love to do that. So HD radio is just a natural progression of that model.
Okay. You really think people are going to pay for HD radio, Tim? I get the bottled water thing, but...
No, I don't think people are going to pay for HD radio unless they make it free and subsidize it.
All right, I'm going to be working on tuning on after this. I'm going to have to tune Tim's sarcasm meter. Make sure we're on the same vibration, the same wavelength. Brett, do you feel the same way? Do you see any potential in HD radio and in Last.fm actually migrating from the web to being on actual radios?
If satellite radio didn't work, I don't see why HD would. Now you need an entire new system instead of just a little receiver. There's no way that this makes any kind of sense unless you are a hardcore audiophile. And since the entire world has already been trained to listen to MP3s via tinny little headsets, then I don't see that there is much market for an HD radio of any kind.
Do you guys have satellite radio?
I used to. It wasn't worth it, though. I mean, if you're going to listen to the radio.
I saw it on my airplane when I was on JetBlue this week. They had a little button for it. I saw that button.
Hello, love JetBlue. I love flying JetBlue. I'm my favorite airline out there. Do you guys like JetBlue?
Love it.
You ever flown JetBlue?
I've actually never flown JetBlue.
It's wow. Nice. You get the DirecTV leather seat.
And it's good. You know,
I did fly American Airlines to Boston 2 weeks ago with my dog, and that was a harrowing experience that
I never want to repeat. What airline did you fly with your dog?
American.
Oh, God. I don't like those old school airlines. I pretty much just try to fly JetBlue and Southwest, right? Mm-hmm. That's where I go. Oh, Virgin. I know. Sorry. Everyone says fly Virgin. I haven't gone on Virgin Airlines yet.
No, Virgin's
I guess
nice.
I should. I don't want wireless on my flights.
The problem was I had to fly
not
with
having wireless access. What were you going to say, Brett? Sorry. Go ahead.
I had to fly with my dog, and there's like no one that supports this anymore except the old airlines. They were the only ones that would fly me nonstop from California to Boston and still let me put my dog underneath the plane.
What were you doing flying across the country with your dog?
Who doesn't fly across the country with their dog? Yeah. I thought you loved your dog, Daisy.
Yeah, you know, I don't fly anywhere with my dog, actually. I have been thinking, though, at some point in my life, I actually would like to get a purse-sized dog. I totally can see the value of purse-sized dogs now. Because they fit in your purse. You could take it anywhere. I've never had a purse-sized dog before, but I saw a purse-sized dog a couple weeks ago when we were out with some friends. This is like 4-pound Chihuahua mix. I understand why celebrities have purse-sized dogs. You just pick it up. It's like you could put it in your pocket. What kind of dog do you have, Brett?
What? Oh, she's this kind of dog. Her mom was a Brittany Spaniel, but we found her in a field. She's just a mutt. She looks like a red wolf, I think is the closest thing. Maybe part coyote, I don't know, but she's definitely
she looks like Yoda. So that's what for those of you who are listening later in the week, his dog looks like Yoda, but a blonde Yoda. So it's very very cute.
Tore out from under her sleeping spot in the desk.
Hey, Tim, I'd like you to kind of intro this next story because it's about Adobe Flash, and I know that you have much better and deeper knowledge than I do. But essentially, Adobe Flash CS5 will make it possible to create apps for the iPhone and iPod Touch. What is this all about? Can you explain this announcement from Adobe and kind of what it means?
Yikes, I lost my page on this one. Oh boy, Daisy, you picked the wrong one. Hold on just a second.
Well, you know what? Why don't we go back to that one? When you get a chance, if you're able to grab that story so you have it in front of you. If not, we'll tackle it next week. There's no rush. But I'm not gonna touch it because I don't feel like that's an Alex and Tim area. And I think I know
enough at this point
not to try to get into the real tech heavy things myself. So Miley Cyrus quit Twitter via YouTube. This is big news, people. Just
this is huge because everyone knows where Miley Cyrus goes, America follows.
Exactly. She had 2 million Twitter followers, Brett.
I know. Huge.
I wonder how many were actually on
America
every day.
Follows.
So she announced this over Twitter. That's the funny thing. She announced this over YouTube. So today's Monday, October 12th. So she puts out a YouTube video saying that she feels like she's getting to the point where she might be tweeting about her pimples. Did she have pimples? What a shock. Yes, I don't know. I wonder what this says. I mean, yeah, Miley Cyrus, fine. Okay. But I wonder if our love affair with Twitter, not us as the new media cognoscenti, is fading because, God, we love Twitter. But I wonder if sort of the celebrity fascination with it is going to fade off. I know it's certainly been a boon for what the CNET article pointed out. It's certainly been a boon for celebrity journalists, for the reporters and such who follow celebrities at us. I mean, as I pointed out before, I mean, they're constantly quoting from a celebrity's Twitter feed. But I wonder if we're going to kind of start to see people slowly, start to see the famous people slowly dropping off of Twitter.
Well, you know, her dad wanted her to give it another try.
Sorry, what? Her dad wanted her what?
Her dad wanted her to keep going with it. He didn't want her to quit. He was encouraging her to stay on Twitter.
Yeah, you know, it's just one of those. It's a father-daughter friction thing, isn't it?
So,
I'm kind of serious to some degree, though. Brett, do you think that Twitter has kind of reached its peak, and that like MySpace that there could be kind of a pushback? Because actually, MediaPost had a great story with some new data from Hitwise that kind of highlights the huge reversals that are going on in the social networking world. You know, Facebook really continues to rise. Its share of traffic has grown 4 times in the last year. Traffic to social sites to 58.6% of traffic to social sites is going to Facebook, up from 19.9% as of last September. Wow, that's huge. Most of that's coming at the expense of MySpace. Twitter is still a drop in the bucket compared to the other ones, but of course it's still growing, but it's just starting. Its growth is kind of starting to slow a little bit. So I just wonder if our love affair with Twitter is starting to end.
I don't know. The way they are measuring the growth on this chart was by how many minutes they're using on the web. And I think that everyone who has ever used Twitter about 3 months deep realizes they're just Twittering way too much and cuts back. And yeah. I think all that we're seeing is that huge boom that we got 3 months ago when Oprah and there was the Ashton Kutcher CNN thing and all of a sudden all of America wanted to try out Twitter. All of those people are reaching that period where they're like, yeah, you know what? I'm tweeting too much. Time to rein it in a little.
You know, I had a girlfriend of mine who actually got rid of her BlackBerry a couple of weeks ago, specifically to cure her tweeting addiction, switched to a Samsung phone. It lasted for about 24 hours. I don't know if she's cured the Twitter addiction, but she's back on the BlackBerry. Final thing I want to get to, listener input. We always like to go to this when we have the opportunity. Chris Adamson asks, how much of a factor do we think keeping the pilot for Glee available on Hulu all summer was in the show's success? He says it sure helps word of mouth to be able to go watch the show after someone tells you how great it was. Case in point, I didn't know about it until they played the Glee Don't Stop Believing as an interstitial at WWDC. That's the Worldwide Developers Conference in June. It's just kind of interesting. The whole idea of using Hulu to build an audience for a show by keeping the old episodes. This has been one of the rubs against Hulu, that a show is only available for 5 weeks, that they have sort of this rolling period of having episodes available for a certain amount of time. I wonder if this, if that show and how it's doing and the fact that that pilot was available all summer sort of portends a new use of Hulu as a promotional vehicle. Colleen here at the headquarters is nodding. She's my girl. We're on the same page, right? Not all the time, but more often than not. All right, what do you guys think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Having it there, you know, gives people a chance to, it's like giving away free samples. You know, if you've got something good and it tastes good and you're giving away a free sample and then you can share that free sample with a friend, that's huge. And I think that's what happened. The kids were home from school. They started passing around, started sharing it. It built an audience. It built anticipation. It was a great idea.
Brett, do you watch Glee?
What he said. Yeah, I think it's a given. I've watched an episode of Glee, and musicals are not my cup of tea. But I think it's a given that if you put it out there and you let people find it and you give them the time to find it, then you're going to build an audience.
You know, that's one of the things that CBS has done over the years that the other networks haven't seemed to do. CBS puts a show on, they keep it in that spot, they let people find it, they let people discover it, whereas other networks, they get nervous, they start moving the shows around, and people can't find them.
I love musicals. Anytime people break out into song, I'm there. I'm watching it. I think we should do that more just in day-to-day life. I really do. I think we should. You know, sometimes when I'm walking down the street,
those are the great
videos. I
do.
I put on my tap dance shoes, and I just start singing on my own. I have a horrible singing voice. Do you know what happened to me in third grade, guys? Would you like to hear? Do you want to hear how I was traumatized?
You have to sing it, though.
You want to hear how I was traumatized by my third grade singer? We had to sing Scotland's Burning, okay? And you know, I had to get up in the middle of the group. Scotland's Burning, look out, look out. Yeah, that's about as good as I sounded. She goes, just mouth the words, child. Just mouth the words. That is what she told me. Just mouth the words. That's how bad I am at singing. That was my dream when I was a kid. I wanted to be a Broadway star. Still love Broadway.
The singing journalist.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to sing on Twim.
That's where you're going.
That's all we've got today. Where can we find you, gentlemen? Tim, where can people find you online?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com or on Twitter, onetimstreet.
And Brett, where would you like people to track you down?
Yeah, I'm at amchecker.com, and I'm amchecker on Twitter, and the BB Live show happens about once a week or so.
For those of you who are watching now, for those of you who are listening later in the week, thank you, as always, for being a part of the show. I'd love to get listener input, story ideas. You can email me anytime, daisywhitney@gmail.com, and you can find me at daisywhitney.com. Tim, did you want to add something?
Blendtec, send in your Blendtec ideas.
Yes. Absolutely. We want some more BlendTech ideas. That's where we weigh in and give you suggestions on how to BlendTech your business with video. And I think that's self-explanatory. We are over and out.